his beard, would stare at her as she walked down the street, becoming, for a few moments, a boy once more, in the spring of his years, with a spring in his step. "They say that Mr. Munday himself is counted amongst your admirers," said Louisa Thorne to Victoria Forrester, one afternoon in May, in the apple orchard. Five girls sat beside and upon the branches of the oldest apple tree in the orchard, its huge trunk making a fine seat and support. And whenever the May breeze blew, the pink blossoms tumbled down like snow, coming to rest in their hair and on their skirts. The afternoon sunlight dappled green and silver and gold through the leaves in the apple orchard. "Mr. Munday," said Victoria Forrester with disdain, "is 45 years of age if he is a day." She made a face to indicate just how old 45 is when you happen to be 17. "Anyway," said Cecilia Hempstock, Louisa's cousin, "he has already been married. I would not wish to marry someone who had already been married. It would be," she opined, "like having someone else break in one's own pony. Personally, I would imagine that to be the sole advantage of marrying a widower," said Amelia Robinson, "that someone else would have removed the rough edges, broken him in, if you will. Also, I would imagine that by that age his lusts would long since have been sated and abated, which would free one from a number of indignities." A flurry of hastily suppressed giggles amid the apple blossom. "Still," said Lucy Pippin hesitantly, "it would be nice to live in the big house, and to have a coach and four, and to be able to travel to London for the season, and to Bath to take the waters, or to Brighton for the sea-bathing, even if Mr. Munday is 45. The other girls shrieked, and flung handfuls of apple blossom at her, and none shrieked more loudly or flung more blossom than Victoria Forrester. Tristram Thorne, at the age of 17, and only 6 months older than Victoria, was half the way between a boy and a man, and was equally uncomfortable in either role. He seemed to be composed chiefly of elbows and Adam's apples. His hair was the brown of sodden straw, and it stuck out at awkward 17-year-old angles, wet and comb it howsoever much he tried. He was painfully shy, which, as is often the manner of the painfully shy, he overcompensated for by being too loud at the wrong times. Most days Tristram was content, or as content as a 17-year-old youth with his world ahead of him can ever be. And when he daydreamed in the fields, or at the tall desk at the back of Munday and Brown's, the village shop, he fancied himself riding the train all the way to London or to Liverpool, of taking a steamship across the grey Atlantic to America, and making his fortune there, among the savages in the new lands. But there were times when the wind blew from beyond the wall, bringing with it the smell of mint and thyme and red currants. And at those times there were strange colours seen in the flames in the fireplaces of the village. When that wind blew, the simplest of devices, from lucifer matches to lantern slides, would no longer function. And at those times Tristram Thorne's daydreams were strange, guilty fantasies, muddled and odd, of journeys through forests to rescue princesses from palaces, dreams of knights and trolls and mermaids. And when these moods came upon him, he'd slip out of the house and lie upon the grass and stare up at the stars. Few of us now have seen the stars as folk saw them then. Our cities and towns cast too much light into the night. But from the village of Wall the stars were laid out like worlds or like ideas, uncountable as the trees in a forest or the leaves on a tree. Tristram would stare into the darkness of the sky until he thought of nothing at all, and then he would go back to his bed and sleep like a dead man. He was a gangling creature of potential, a barrel of dynamite waiting for someone or something to light his fuse, but no one did. So on weekends and in the evenings, he helped his father on the farm, and during the day he worked for Mr. Brown at Munday and Brown's as a clerk. Munday and Brown's was the village shop. While they kept a number of necessaries in stock, most of their business was conducted by means of lists. Villagers would give Mr. Brown a list of what they needed, from potted meats to sheep dip, from fish knives to chimney tiles. A clerk at Munday and Brown's would compile a master list of everything requested, and then Mr. Monday would take the master list in a dray pulled by two huge shire horses, and he would set off for the nearest county town, and return in a handful of days with the dray loaded high with goods of all description. It was a cold, blustery day in late October, of the kind that always seems about to rain but never actually does, and it was late in the afternoon. Victoria Forrester walked into Monday and Brown's with a list written in her mother's precise handwriting, and she rang the small bell on the counter for service. She looked slightly disappointed to see Tristram Thorne appear from the back room. "Good day, Miss Forrester." She smiled a tight smile and handed Tristram her list. It read as follows. 1/2 pound of sago, 10 cans of sardines, 1 bottle of mushroom ketchup, 5 pounds of rice, 1 tin of golden syrup, 2 pounds of currants, 1 bottle of cochineal, 1 pound of barley sugar, 1 shilling box of Roundtree's Elect Cocoa, 1/3 tin of Oakey's Knife Polish, 6 pence of Brunswick Black, 1 packet of Swinburne's Isinglass, 1 bottle of furniture cream, 1 basting ladle, 9 penny gravy strainer, 1 set of kitchen steps. Tristram read it to himself, looking for something about which he could begin to talk, a conversational gambit of some kind, any kind. He heard his voice saying, "You'll be having rice pudding then, I would imagine, Miss Forrester." As soon as he said it, he knew it had been the wrong thing to say. Victoria pursed her perfect lips and blinked her grey eyes and said, "Yes, Tristram, we shall be having rice pudding." And then she smiled at him and said, "Mother says that rice pudding in sufficient quantity will help to stave off chills and colds and other autumnal ailments." "My mother," Tristram confessed, "has always sworn by tapioca pudding." He put the list on a spike. "We can deliver most of the provisions tomorrow morning, and the rest of it will come back with Mr. Monday early next week." There was a gust of wind then, so strong that it rattled the windows of the village and whirled and spun the weathercock, until they could not tell north from west or south from east. The fire that was burning in the grate of Monday and Brown's belched and twisted in a flurry of greens and scarlets, topped with a fizz of silver twinkles of the kind one can make for oneself at the parlour fire with a handful of tossed iron filings. The wind blew from Fairy in the east, and Tristram Thorne suddenly found inside himself a certain amount of courage he had not suspected that he had possessed. "You know, Miss Forrester, I get off in a few minutes," he said. "Perhaps I could walk you a little way home. It's not much out of my way." And he waited, his heart in his mouth, while Victoria Forrester's grey eyes stared at him, amused. After what seemed like 100 years, she said, "Certainly." Tristram hurried into the parlour and informed Mr. Brown that he would be off now. And Mr. Brown grunted in a not entirely ill-natured way and told Tristram that when he was younger he'd not only had to stay late each night and shut up the shop, but he'd also had to sleep on the floor beneath the counter with only his coat for a pillow. Tristram agreed that he was indeed a lucky young man, and he wished Mr. Brown a good night. Then he took his coat from the coat stand and his new bowler hat from the hat stand and stepped out onto the cobblestones where Victoria Forrester waited for him. The autumn twilight turned into a deep and early night as they walked. Tristram could smell the distant winter on the air, a mixture of night mist and crisp darkness, and the tang of fallen leaves. They took a winding lane up toward the Forrester farm, and the crescent moon hung white in the sky, and the stars burned in the darkness above them. "Victoria," said Tristram, after a while. "Yes, Tristram," said Victoria, who'd been preoccupied for much of the walk. "Would you think it forward of me to kiss you?" asked Tristram. "Yes," said Victoria, bluntly and coldly. "Very forward." "Ah," said Tristram. They walked up Dighty's Hill, not speaking. At the top of the hill, they turned and saw beneath them the village of Wall, all gleaming candles and lamps glimmering through windows, warm yellow lights that beckoned and invited, and above them the lights of the myriad stars, which glittered and twinkled and blazed, chilly and distant and more numerous than the mind could encompass. Tristram reached down his hand and took Victoria's small hand in his. She did not pull away. "Did you see that?" asked Victoria, who was gazing out over the landscape. "I saw nothing," said Tristram. "I was looking at you." Victoria smiled in the moonlight. "You are the most lovely woman in all the world," said Tristram from the bottom of his heart. get along with you," said Victoria, but she said it gently. "What did you see?" asked Tristram. "A falling star," said Victoria. "I believe they are not at all uncommon at this time of year." "Vicky," said Tristram, "will you kiss me?" "No," she said. "You kissed me when we were younger. You kissed me beneath the pledge oak on your 15th birthday, and you kissed me last May Day behind your father's cowshed." "I was another person then," she said, "and I shall not kiss you, Tristram Thorne." "If you will not kiss me," asked Tristram, "will you marry me?" There was silence on the hill, only the rustle of the October wind, then a tinkling sound. It was the sound of the most beautiful girl in the whole of the British Isles, laughing with delight and amusement. "Marry you?" she repeated incredulously. "And why ever should I marry you, Tristram Thorne? What could you give me?" "Give you?" he said. I would go to India for you, Victoria Forrester, and bring you the tusks of elephants and pearls as big as your thumb and rubies the size of wren's eggs. I would go to Africa and bring you diamonds the size of cricket balls. I would find the source of the Nile and name it after you. I would go to America, all the way to San Francisco, to the gold fields, and I would not come back until I had your weight in gold, and then I would carry it back here and lay it at your feet. I would travel to the distant Northlands, did you but say the word, and slay the mighty polar bears and bring you back their hides. I think you were doing quite well, said Victoria Forrester, until you got to the bit about slaying polar bears. Be that as it may, little shop boy and farm boy, I shall not kiss you, neither shall I marry you. Tristram's eyes blazed in the moonlight. I would travel to far Cathay for you and bring you a huge junk. I would capture from the king of the pirates, laden with jade and silk and opium. I would go to Australia, at the bottom of the world, said Tristram, and bring you, He ransacked the penny dreadfuls in his head, trying to remember if any of their heroes had visited Australia. "A kangaroo," he said. "And opals," he added. He was fairly sure about the opals. Victoria Forrester squeezed his hand. "And whatever would I do with a kangaroo?" she asked. "Now, we should be getting along, or my father and mother will be wondering what has kept me, and they will leap to some entirely unjustified conclusions, for I have not kissed you, Tristram Thorne." "Kiss me," he pleaded. "There's nothing I would not do for your kiss. No mountain I would not scale, no river I would not ford, no desert I would not cross." He gestured widely, indicating the village of Wall below them, the night sky above them, and the constellation of Orion, low on the eastern horizon, a star flashed, glittered, and fell. "For a kiss and the pledge of your hand," said Tristram grandiloquently, "I would bring you that fallen star." He shivered. His coat was thin, and it was obvious he would not get his kiss, which he found puzzling. The manly heroes of the penny dreadfuls and shilling novels never had these problems getting kissed. "Go on, then," said Victoria, "and if you do, I will." "What?" said Tristram. "If you bring me that star," said Victoria, "the one that just fell, not another star, then I'll kiss you. Who knows what else I might do? There, now you need not go to Australia, nor to Africa, nor to far Cathay." "What?" said Tristram. And Victoria laughed at him then, and took back her hand and began to walk down the hill toward her father's farm. Tristram ran to catch her up. "Do you mean it?" he asked her. "I mean it as much as you mean all your fancy words of rubies and gold and opium," she replied. "What is an opium?" "Something in cough mixture," said Tristram, "like eucalyptus." "It does not sound particularly romantic," said Victoria Forrester. "Anyway, should you not be running off to retrieve my fallen star? It fell to the east, over there." And she laughed again. "Silly shop boy, it's all you can do to ensure that we have the ingredients for rice pudding." "And if I brought you the fallen star," asked Tristram lightly, "what would you give me? A kiss? Your hand in marriage?" "Anything you desire," said Victoria, amused. "You swear it?" asked Tristram. They were walking the last 100 yards now, up to the Forester's farmhouse. The windows burned with lamplight, yellow and orange. "Of course," said Victoria, smiling. The track to the forester's farm was bare mud, trodden into mire by the feet of horses and cows and sheep and dogs. Tristram Thorne went down on his knees in the mud, heedless of his coat or his woolen trousers. "Very well," he said. The wind blew from the east then. "I shall leave you here, my lady," said Tristram Thorne, "for I have urgent business to the east." He stood up, unmindful of the mud and mire clinging to his knees and coat, and he bowed to her, and then he doffed his bowler hat. Victoria Forrester laughed at the skinny shop boy, laughed long and loud and delightfully, and her tinkling laughter followed him back down the hill and away. Tristram Thorne ran all the way home. Bramble snagged at his clothes as he ran, and a branch knocked his hat from his head. He stumbled, breathless and torn, into the kitchen of the house on Westwood Meadows. "Look at the state of you," said his mother. "Indeed, I never did." Tristram merely smiled at her. "Tristram," asked his father, who at 35 was still middling tall and still freckled, although there were more than a few silvering hairs in his nut-brown curls. "Your mother spoke to you. Did you not hear her?"
"I beg your pardon, father, mother," said Tristram, "but I shall be leaving the village tonight. I may be gone for some time."
"Foolishness and silliness," said Daisy Thorne. "I never heard such nonsense." But Dunstan Thorne saw the look in his son's eyes. "Let me talk to him," he said to his wife. She looked at him sharply, then she nodded.
"Very well," she said, "but who's going to sew up the boy's coat? That's what I would like to know."
She bustled out of the kitchen. The kitchen fire fizzed in silver and glimmered green and violet.
"Where are you going?" asked Dunstan.
"East,"
said his son. "East." His father nodded. There were two easts, east to the next county through the forest, and east, the other side of the wall. Dunstan Thorne knew without asking to which his son was referring.
"And will you be coming back?" asked his father.
Tristram grinned widely.
"Of course," he said.
"Well," said his father, "that's all right then."
He scratched his nose.
"Have you, given any thought to getting through the wall?"
Tristram shook his head.
"I'm sure I can find a way," he said. "If necessary, I'll fight my way past the guards."
His father sniffed.
"I'll do no such thing," he said. "Would you like it if it was you was on duty or me? I'll not see anyone hurt."
He scratched the side of his nose once more.
"Go and pack a bag and kiss your mother goodbye, and I'll walk you down to the village."
Tristram packed a bag, and his mother brought him 6 red ripe apples and a cottage loaf and a round of white farmhouse cheese, which he placed inside his bag. Mrs. Thorne would not look at Tristram. He kissed her cheek and bade her farewell. Then he walked into the village with his father. Tristram had stood his first watch on the wall when he was 16 years old. He had only been given one instruction, that it was the task of the guards to prevent anyone from coming through the gap in the wall from the village by any means possible. If it was not possible to prevent them, then the guards must raise the village for help. He wondered, as they walked, what his father had in mind. Perhaps the two of them together would overpower the guards. Perhaps his father would create some kind of distraction and allow him to slip through. Perhaps, by the time they walked through the village and arrived at the gap in the wall, Tristram had imagined every possibility, except the one which occurred. On wall duty that evening were Harold Crutchbeck and Mr. Bromios. Harold Crutchbeck was a husky young man several years older than Tristram, the miller's son. Mr. Bromios's hair was black and curled, and his eyes were green, and his smile was white, and he smelled of grapes and of grape juice, of barley and of hops. Dunstan Thorne walked up to Mr. Bromios and stood in front of him. He stamped his feet against the evening chill.
"Evening, Mr. Bromios. Evening, Harold," said Dunstan.
"Evening, Mr. Thorne," said Harold Crutchbeck.
"Good evening, Dunstan," said Mr. Bromios. "I trust you are well."
Dunstan allowed as that he was, and they spoke of the weather, and agreed that it would be bad for the farmers, and that, from the quantity of holly berries and yew berries already apparent, it would be a cold, hard winter.
As he listened to them talking, Tristram was ready to burst with irritation and frustration, but he bit his tongue and said nothing. Finally, his father said,
Mr. Bromios, Harold, I believe you both know my son, Tristan.
Tristan raised his bowler hat to them, nervously. And then his father said something he did not understand.
I suppose you both know about where he came from, said Dunstan Thorne.
Mr. Bromios nodded, without speaking.
Harold Crutchbeck said he'd heard tales, although you should never mind the half of what you hear.
Well, it's true, said Dunstan. And now it's time for him to go back.
There's a star, Tristram began to explain, but his father hushed him to silence. Mr. Bromios rubbed his chin and ran a hand through his thatch of black curls.
Very well, he said.
He turned and spoke to Harold in a low voice, saying things Tristram could not hear. His father pressed something cold into his hand.
Go on with you, boy. Go and bring back your star and me. God and all his angels go with you.
And Mr. Bromios and Harold Crutchbeck, the guards on the gate, stood aside to let him pass. Tristram walked through the gap, with the stone wall on each side of him, into the meadow on the other side of the wall. Turning, he looked back at the three men framed in the gap and wondered why they had allowed him through. Then, his bag swinging in one hand, the object his father had pushed into his hand in the other, Tristram Thorne set off up the gentle hill toward the woods. As he walked, the chill of the night grew less, and once in the woods at the top of the hill, Tristram was surprised to realize the moon was shining brightly down on him through a gap in the trees. He was surprised because the moon had set an hour before, and doubly surprised because the moon that had set had been a slim, sharp, silver crescent, and the moon that shone down on him now was a huge golden harvest moon, full and glowing and deeply coloured. The cold thing in his hand chimed once, a crystalline tinkling like the bells of a tiny glass cathedral. He opened his hand and held it up to the moonlight. It was a snowdrop made all of glass. A warm wind stroked Tristram's face. It smelled like peppermint and black currant leaves and red ripe plums. And the enormity of what he had done descended on Tristram Thorne. He was walking into Faerie, in search of a fallen star, with no idea how he would find the star, nor how to keep himself safe and whole as he tried. He looked back, and fancied that he could see the lights of wall behind him, wavering and glimmering, as if in a heat haze, but still inviting. And he knew that if he turned around and went back, no one would think any less of him for it, not his father, or his mother, and even Victoria Forrester would likely as not merely smile at him the next time she saw him and call him shop boy, and add that stars, once fallen, often proved difficult in the finding. He paused then. He thought of Victoria's lips and her grey eyes and the sound of her laughter. He straightened his shoulders, placed the crystal snowdrop in the top buttonhole of his coat, now undone. And too ignorant to be scared, too young to be awed, Tristram Thorne passed beyond the fields we know and into Faerie.
Chapter 3, in which we encounter several other persons, many of them still alive, with an interest in the fate of the fallen star. The Stormhold had been carved out of the peak of Mount Huon by the first Lord of Stormhold, who reigned at the end of the First Age and into the beginning of the Second. It had been expanded, improved upon, excavated and tunnelled into by successive masters of Stormhold, until the original mountain peak now raked the sky like the ornately carved tusk of some great grey granite beast. The Stormhold itself was perched high in the sky, where the thunderclouds gathered before they went down to the lower air, spilling rain and lightning and devastation upon the place beneath. The 81st Lord of Stormhold lay dying in his chamber, which was carved from the highest peak like a hole in a rotten tooth. There is still death in the lands beyond the fields we know.
He summoned his children to his bedside, and they came, the living and the dead of them, and they shivered in the cold granite halls. They gathered about his bed and waited respectfully, the living to his right side, the dead on his left. Four of his sons were dead, Secundus, Quintus, Quartus, and Sextus, and they stood unmoving, grey figures, insubstantial and silent. Three of his sons remained alive, Primus, Tertius, and Septimus. They stood solidly, uncomfortably, on the right of the chamber, shifting from foot to foot, scratching their cheeks and noses, as if they were shamed by the silent repose of their dead brothers. They did not glance across the room toward their dead brothers, acting as best they could, as if they and their father were the only ones in that cold room, where the windows were huge holes in the granite through which the cold winds blew. And whether this is because they could not see their dead brothers, or because, having murdered them, one apiece, save Septimus, who had killed both Quintus and Sextus, poisoning the former with a dish of spiced eels, and, rejecting artifice for efficiency and gravity, simply pushing Sextus off a precipice one night as they were admiring a lightning storm far below. They chose to ignore them, scared of guilt, or revelation, or ghosts. Their father did not know. Privately, the 81st Lord had hoped that by the time his end came upon him, six of the seven young lords at Stormhold would be dead, and but one still alive. That one would be the 82nd Lord of Stormhold and Master of the High Crags. It was, after all, how he had attained his own title several hundred years before. But the youth of today were a pasty lot, with none of the get-up-and-go, none of the vigour and vim that he remembered from the days when he was young. Somebody was saying something. He forced himself to concentrate. "Father," repeated Primus in his deep boom of a voice, "we are all here. What would you do with us?" The old man stared at him. With a ghastly wheezing, he pulled a breath of the thin, chill air into his lungs, and then said in high, cold tones, like the granite itself, "I am dying. Soon my time will be done, and you will take my remains deep into the mountain to the Hall of Ancestors, and you will place them, me, in the 180th hollow you come to, which is to say, the first that is not occupied, and there you shall leave me. If you do not do this thing, you will each be cursed, and the Tower of Stormhold shall tumble and fall." His three living sons said nothing. A murmur ran through the four dead sons, though, regret, perhaps, that their remains had been gobbled up by eagles, or carried away by the fast rivers, tumbled down waterfalls and off to the sea, never to rest in the Hall of Ancestors. "Now, the matter of succession." The Lord's voice wheezed out of him, like the wind being squeezed from a pair of rotten bellows. His living sons raised their heads. Primus, the oldest, with white hairs in his thick brown beard, his nose aquiline, his eyes grey, looked expectant. Tertius, his beard red and golden, his eyes a tawny brown, looked wary. Septimus, his black beard still coming in, tall and crow-like, looked blank, as he always looked blank. "Primus, go to the window." Primus strode over to the opening in the rock wall and looked out. "What do you see?"
"Nothing, sire. I see the evening sky above us and clouds below us." The old man shivered beneath the mountain bear skin that covered him.
"Tertius, go to the window. What do you see?"
"Nothing, father. It is as Primus told you. The evening sky hangs above us, the colour of a bruise, and clouds carpet the world beneath us, all grey and writhing."
The old man's eyes twisted in his face, like the mad eyes of a bird of prey.
"Septimus, you, window."
Septimus strolled to the window, and stood beside, although not too close to, his two elder brothers.
"And you, what do you see?"
He looked out of the opening. The wind was bitter on his face, and it made his eyes sting and tear. One star glimmered, faintly, in the indigo heavens.
"I see a star, father."
"Ah,"
wheezed the 81st Lord.
"Bring me to the window."
His four dead sons looked at him sadly, as his three living sons carried him to the window. The old man stood, or almost stood, leaning heavily on the broad shoulders of his children, staring into the leaden sky. His fingers, swollen-knuckled and twig-like, fumbled with the topaz that hung on a heavy silver chain about his neck. The chain parted like a cobweb in the old man's grip. He held the topaz out in his fist, the broken ends of silver chain dangling. The dead lords of Stormhold whispered amongst themselves in the voices of the dead, which sound like snow falling. The topaz was the power of Stormhold. Who wore it would be Stormhold's master as long as he was of the blood of Stormhold. To which of the surviving sons would the 81st lord give the stone? The living sons said nothing, but looked respectively expectant, wary, and blank. But it was a deceptive blankness, the blankness of a rock face that one only realizes cannot be climbed when one is halfway up and there is no longer any way down. The old man pulled free of his sons and stood straight and tall then. He was, for a heartbeat, the lord of Stormhold who had defeated the northern goblins at the Battle of Craglan's Head, who had fathered 8 children, 7 of them boys, on 3 wives, who had killed each of his 4 brothers in combat before he was 20 years old, although his oldest brother had been almost 5 times his age and a mighty warrior of great renown. It was this man who held up the topaz and said 4 words in a long dead tongue, words which hung on the air like the strokes of a huge bronze gong. Then he threw the stone into the air. The living brothers caught their breath as the stone arced up over the clouds. It reached what they were certain must be the zenith of its curve, and then, defying all reason, it continued to rise into the air. Other stars glittered in the night sky now. "To he who retrieves the stone, which is the power of Stormhold, I leave my blessing and the mastership of Stormhold and all its dominions," said the 81st lord, his voice losing power as he spoke, until once again it was the creak of an old, old man like the wind blowing through an abandoned house. The brothers, living and dead, stared at the stone. It fell upwards into the sky, until it was lost to sight.
"And should we capture eagles and harness them to drag us into the heavens?" asked Tertius, puzzled and annoyed.
His father said nothing. The last of the daylight faded, and the stars hung above them, uncountable in their glory. One star fell. Tertius thought, although he was not certain, that it was the first star of the evening, the one that his brother Septimus had remarked upon. The star tumbled, a streak of light, through the night sky, and it tumbled down somewhere to the south and west of them. "There," whispered the 81st lord, and he fell to the stone floor of his chamber, and he breathed no more. Primus scratched his beard and looked down at the crumpled thing.
"I've half a mind," he said, "to push the old bastard's corpse out of the window. What was all that idiocy about?"
"Better not," said Tertius. "We don't want to see Stormhold tumble and fall, nor do we want a curse on our heads for that matter. Better just place him in the Hall of Ancestors."
Primus picked his father's body up and carried him back to the furs of his bed.
"We will tell the people he is dead," he said.
The 4 dead brothers clustered with Septimus at the window. "What do you think he's thinking?" asked Quintus of Sextus.
"He's wondering where the stone fell, and how to reach it first," said Sextus, remembering his fall down the rocks and into eternity.
"I damn well hope so," said the late 81st master of Stormhold to his 4 dead sons.
But his 3 sons, who were not yet dead, heard nothing at all.
A question like, "How big is fairy?" does not admit of a simple answer. Fairy, after all, is not one land, one principality or dominion. Maps of fairy are unreliable and may not be depended upon. We talk of the kings and queens of fairy as we would speak of the kings and queens of England. But fairy is bigger than England, as it is bigger than the world. For since the dawn of time, each land that has been forced off the map by explorers and the brave going out and proving it wasn't there has taken refuge in fairy. So it is now, by the time that we come to write of it, a most huge place indeed, containing every manner of landscape and terrain. Here truly there be dragons. Also griffins, wyverns, hippogriffs, basilisks, and hydras. There are all manner of more familiar animals as well, cats affectionate and aloof, dogs noble and cowardly, wolves and foxes, eagles and bears. In the middle of a wood, so thick and so deep it was very nearly a forest, was a small house built of thatch and wood and daubed grey clay, which had a most foreboding aspect. A small yellow bird in a cage sat on its perch outside the house. It did not sing, but sat mournfully silent, its feathers ruffled and wan. There was a door to the cottage, from which the once white paint was peeling away. Inside, the cottage consisted of one room, undivided. Smoked meats and sausages hung from the rafters, along with a wizened crocodile carcass. A peat fire burned smokily in the large fireplace against one wall, and the smoke trickled out of the chimney far above. There were three blankets upon three raised beds, one large and old, the other two little more than truckle beds. There were cooking implements, and a large wooden cage, currently empty, in another corner. There were windows too filthy to see through, and over everything was a thick layer of oily dust. The only thing in the house that was clean was a mirror of black glass, as high as a tall man, as wide as a church door, which rested against one wall. The house belonged to three aged women. They took it in turns to sleep in the big bed, to make the supper, to set snares in the wood for small animals, to draw water up from the deep well behind the house. The three women spoke little. There were three other women in the little house. They were slim and dark and amused. The hall they inhabited was many times the size of the cottage. The floor was of onyx, and the pillars were of obsidian. There was a courtyard behind them, open to the sky, and stars hung in the night sky above. A fountain played in the courtyard, the water rolling and falling from a statue of a mermaid in ecstasy, her mouth wide open. Clean black water gushed from her mouth into the pool below, shimmering and shaking the stars. The three women and their hall were in the black mirror. The three old women were the Lilim, the witch queen, all alone in the woods. The three women in the mirror were also the Lilim, but whether they were the successors to the old women, or their shadow selves, or whether only the peasant cottage in the woods was real, or if somewhere the Lilim lived in a black hall with a fountain in the shape of a mermaid playing in the courtyard of stars, none knew for certain, and none but the Lilim could say. On this day, one crone came in from the woods carrying a stoat, its throat a splash of red. She placed it on the dusty chopping board and took a sharp knife. She cut it around at the arms and legs and neck. Then with one filthy hand she pulled the skin off the creature as if pulling a child from its pajamas. And she dropped the naked thing onto the wooden chopping block.
"Entrails?"
she asked in a quavering voice. The smallest, oldest, most tangle-headed of the women rocking back and forth in a rocking chair said,
"Might as well."
The first old woman picked up the stoat by the head and sliced it from neck to groin. Its innards tumbled out onto the cutting board, red and purple and plum-coloured, intestines and vital organs like wet jewels on the dusty wood. The woman screeched,
"Come quick, come quick!"
Then she pushed gently at the stoat guts with her knife and screeched once more. The crone in the rocking chair pulled herself to her feet in the mirror. The dark woman stretched and rose from her divan. The last old woman, returning from the outhouse, scurried as fast as she could from the woods.
"What?" she said. "What is it?"
In the mirror, a third young woman rejoined the other two. Her breasts were small and high, and her eyes were dark.
"Look,"
gestured the first old woman, pointing with her knife. Their eyes were the colourless grey of extreme age, and they squinted at the organs on the slab.
"At last," said one of them, and "About time," said another. "Which of us, then, to find it?" asked the third.
The three women closed their eyes, and three old hands stabbed into the stoat guts on the board. An old hand opened.
"I've a kidney. I've his liver."
The third hand opened. It belonged to the oldest of the Lilim.
"I've his heart," she said triumphantly. "How will you travel? In our old chariot drawn by what I find at the crossroads. You'll be needing some years."
The oldest one nodded. The youngest, the one who had come in from the outhouse, walked painfully slowly over to a high and ramshackle chest of drawers and bent over. She took a rusting iron box from the bottommost drawer and carried it over to her sister's. It was tied around with three pieces of old string, each with a different knot in it. Each of the women unknotted her own piece of string. Then the one who had carried the box opened the lid. Something glittered golden in the bottom of the box.
"Not much left,"
sighed the youngest of the Lilim, who had been old when the wood they lived in was still beneath the sea.
"Then it's a good thing that we found a new one, isn't it?"
said the oldest, tartly, and with that she thrust a clawed hand into the box. Something golden tried to avoid her hand, but she caught it, wiggling and glimmering, opened her mouth, and popped it inside. In the mirror, three women stared out. There was a shivering and a shuddering at the center of all things. Now, two women stared from the black mirror. In the cottage, two old women stared, envy and hope mixing in their faces, at a tall, handsome woman, with black hair and dark eyes and red, red lips.
"My," she said, "but this place is filthy."
She strode to the bed. Beside it was a large wooden chest, covered by a faded tapestry. She twitched off the tapestry and opened the chest, rummaging inside. "Here we go," she said, holding up a scarlet kirtle. She tossed it onto the bed and pulled off the rags and tatters she had worn as an old woman. Her two sisters stared across at her naked body hungrily. "When I return with her heart, there will be years of plenty for all of us," she said, eyeing her sisters' hairy chins and hollow eyes with disfavor. She slipped a scarlet bracelet onto her wrist in the shape of a small snake with its tail between its jaws.
"A star," said one of her sisters. "A star," echoed the second.
"Exactly," said the witch queen, putting a circlet of silver upon her head. "The first in 200 years, and I'll bring it back to us." She licked her scarlet lips with a deep red tongue.
"A fallen star," she said.
It was night in the glade by the pool, and the sky was bespattered with stars beyond counting. Fireflies glittered in the leaves of the elm trees, and in the ferns and in the hazel bushes, flickering on and off like the lights of a strange and distant city. An otter splashed in the brook that fed the pool. A family of stoats wove and wound their way to the water to drink. A field mouse found a fallen hazelnut and began to bite into the hard shell of the nut with its sharp, ever-growing front teeth, not because it was hungry, but because it was a prince under an enchantment who could not regain his outer form until he chewed the nut of wisdom, but its excitement made it careless, and only the shadow that blotted out the moonlight warned it of the descent of a huge grey owl who caught the mouse in its sharp talons and rose again into the night. The mouse dropped the nut, which fell into the brook and was carried away to be swallowed by a salmon. The owl swallowed the mouse in just a couple of gulps, leaving just its tail trailing from her mouth like a length of bootlace. Something snuffled and grunted as it pushed through the thicket. A badger, thought the owl, herself under a curse, and only able to resume her rightful shape if she consumed a mouse who had eaten the nut of wisdom, or perhaps a small bear. Leaves rustled, water rilled,
and then the glade became filled with light shining down from above, a pure white light which grew brighter and brighter. The owl saw it reflected in the pool, a blazing, glaring thing of pure light, so bright that she took to the wing and flew to another part of the forest. The wild things looked about them in terror. First the light in the sky was no bigger than the moon. Then it seemed larger, infinitely larger, and the whole grove trembled and quivered, and every creature held its breath, and the fireflies glowed brighter than they had ever glowed in their lives, each one convinced that this at last was love, but to no avail. And then there was a cracking sound, sharp as a shot, and the light that had filled the grove was gone, or almost gone. There was a dim glow, pulsing from the middle of the hazel thicket, as if a tiny cloud of stars were glimmering there. And there was a voice, a high, clear female voice, which said, "Ow!" And then, very quietly, it said, "Fuck!" And then it said, "Ow!" once more. And then it said nothing at all, and there was silence in the glade. Chapter 4. Can I Get There by Candlelight? October moved further away with every step Tristram took. He felt as if he were walking into summer. There was a path through the woods, with a high hedgerow to one side, and he followed the path. High above him the stars glittered and gleamed, and the harvest moon shone golden yellow, the colour of ripe corn. In the moonlight he could see briar roses in the hedge. He was becoming sleepy now. For a time he fought to stay awake, and then he took off his overcoat and put down his bag, a large leather bag of the kind that, in 20 years' time, would become known as a Gladstone bag, and he laid his head on his bag and covered himself with his coat. He stared up at the stars, and it seemed to him then that they were dancers, stately and graceful, performing a dance almost infinite in its complexity. He imagined he could see the very faces of the stars, pale they were, and smiling gently as if they'd spent so much time above the world, watching the scrambling and the joy and the pain of the people below them, that they could not help being amused every time another little human believed itself the center of its world, as each of us does. And then it came to Tristram that he was dreaming, and he walked into his bedroom, which was also the schoolroom of the village of War, and Mrs. Cherry tapped the blackboard and bade them all be silent, and Tristram looked down at his slate to see what the lesson would be about, but he could not read what he had written there. Then Mrs. Cherry, who resembled his mother so much that Tristram found himself astonished he had never before realized that they were the same person, called upon Tristram to tell the class the dates of all the kings and queens of England. "Excuse me," said a small and hairy voice in his ear, "but would you mind dreaming a bit quieter? Your dreams is spilling over into my dreams, and if there's one thing I've never been doing with, it's dates. William the Conqueror, 1066, that's as far as I go, and I'd swap that for a dancing mouse." "Hmm?" said Tristram. "Keep it down," said the voice, "if you don't mind." "Sorry," said Tristram, and his dreams after that were of the dark. "Breakfast," said a voice close to his ear. "It's mushrumps, fried in butter, with wild garlic." Tristram opened his eyes. Daylight shone through the briar rose hedge, dappling the grass in gold and green. Something smelled like heaven. A tin container was placed beside him. "Poor fare," said the voice. "Country fare it is. Nothing like the gentry are used to, but the likes of me treasures a fine mushrump." Tristram blinked and reached into the tin bowl and took out a large mushroom between finger and thumb. It was hot. He took a careful bite, felt the juices flood his mouth. It was the finest thing he had ever eaten, and after he'd chewed and swallowed it, he said so. "That's kind of you," said the small figure, who sat on the other side of a little fire which crackled and smoked in the morning air. "Kind of you, I'm sure, but you know, and I know, that it's just fried field mushrumps and never a patch or nothing proper." "Is there any more?" asked Tristram, realizing just how hungry he was. Sometimes a little food can do that to you. "Ah, oh, now there's manners for you," said the little figure, who wore a large floppy hat and a large flappy overcoat. "Is there more?" he says, as if it were poached quail's eggs and smoked gazelle and truffles, not just a mushrump what tastes more or less like something what's been dead for a week and a cat wouldn't touch. "Manners,"
I really, truly would like another mushroom, said Tristram, if it's not too much trouble. The little man, if man he was, which Tristram found rather unlikely, sighed mournfully and reached into the pan sizzling on the fire with his knife and flicked two large mushrooms into Tristram's tin bowl. Tristram blew on them, then ate them with his fingers. Look at you, said the little hairy person, his voice a mixture of pride and gloom. Eating those mushrumps as if you liked them, as if they wasn't sawdust and wormwood and rue in your mouth. Tristram licked his fingers and assured his benefactor that they had been the very finest mushrooms he had ever had the privilege of eating. You says that now, said his host with gloomy relish, but you'll not be saying that in an hour's time. They'll undoubtedly disagree with you, like the fishwife who disagreed with her young man over a mermaid, and that could be heard from Garamond to Stormhold. Such language, it fair turned my ears blue, it did. The little hairy personage sighed deeply. Ah, talking about your guts, he said, I'm going to attend to mine behind that tree over there. Would you do me the signal honour of keeping an eye on that there pack of mine? I'd be obliged. Of course, said Tristram, politely. The little hairy man vanished behind an oak tree. Tristram heard a few grunts, and then his new friend reappeared, saying, There. I knowed a man in Paphlagonia who'd swallow a live snake every morning when he got up. He used to say he was certain of one thing, that nothing worse would happen to him all day. Of course, they made him eat a bowl full of hairy centipedes before they hung him, so maybe that claim was a bit presumptive. Tristram excused himself. He urinated against the side of the oak tree, next to which was a small mound of droppings, certainly not produced by any human being. They looked like deer pellets or rabbit droppings. My name is Tristram Thorne, said Tristram when he returned. His breakfast companion had packed up the morning's breakfast, fire, pans and all, and made it vanish into his pack. He removed his hat, pressed it to his chest and looked up at Tristram. Charmed, he said. He tapped the side of his pack. On it was written, Charmed, enchanted, ensorcelled, and confusticated. I used to be confusticated, he confided, but you know how these things go. And with that, he set off along the path. Tristram walked behind him. Hey, I say, called Tristram, slow down, can't you? For despite the huge pack, which put Tristram in mind of Christian's Burden in Pilgrim's Progress, a book from which Mrs. Cherry had read to them every Monday morning, telling them that, although it was written by a tinker, it was a fine book for all of that. The little man, Charmed? Was that his name? Was moving away from him as fast as a squirrel up a tree. The little creature hurried back down the path. Something wrong? He asked. I cannot keep up, confessed Tristram. You walk so confoundedly fast. The little hairy man slowed his pace. Beg your pardon, he said as Tristram stumbled after him. Being on me own so much, I gets used to setting me own pace. They walked side by side in the golden green light of the sun through the newly opened leaves. It was a quality of light Tristram had observed unique to springtime. He wondered if they'd left summer as far behind as October. From time to time, Tristram would remark on a flash of colour in a tree or bush, and the little hairy man would say something like, Kingfisher, Mr. Halcyon, they used to call him. Pretty bird. Or purple hummingbird, drinks nectar from flowers, hovers, or red cap. They'll keep their distance, but don't you go scrutinising them or looking for trouble, because you'll find it with those buggers. They sat beside a brook to eat their lunch. Tristram produced the cottage loaf, the ripe red apples and round of cheese, hard, tart and crumbly, that his mother had given him. And although the little man eyed them both suspiciously, he wolfed them down and licked the crumbs of bread and cheese from his fingers and munched noisily on the apple. Then he filled a kettle from the brook and boiled it up for tea. "Suppose you tell me what you're about," said the little hairy man, as they sat on the ground and drank their tea. Tristram thought for some moments, and then he said, "I come from the village of Wall, where there lives a young lady named Victoria Forrester, who is without peer among women. And it is to her, and to her alone, that I have given my heart. Her face is... usual complement of bits? Asked the little creature. Eyes, nose, teeth, all the usual? Of course. Well, then you can skip that stuff, said the little hairy man.